Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we learn about the poetic side of actor and comedian Bill Murray, visit a tap dancing festival in Chicago, talk to a man who runs a freak show in California, and hear about a street drummer who plays on just about anything he can get his hands on. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. A 300-year-old art form is making an appearance in Chicago. Hundreds of people are in the Windy City from around the world to take tap classes as part of the Chicago Human Rhythm Project's summer festival called Rhythm World. It's billed as the oldest and largest tap dance festival in North America. Some of the participants spent a recent evening trying to outdo each other in front of a live audience. Lynette Kalsnes has this report.
Danny Aiken is a summer intern with the Rhythm Project, but he's also a contestant in a tap improv show that's just about to start. So he's practicing his steps while going over last-minute details on a clipboard.
Describe what footwear you're tapping in.
I'm tapping in a pair of flip-flops.
Of course, he'll change into tap shoes for the cutting contest. It starts with 17 people. They face off two at a time. The first contestant taps out a measure of music and the other dancer responds. They go back and forth, showing off their footwork and stealing each other's moves. It's the tap equivalent of take that or top this. That was the William Tell Overture.
If your phrasing is just completely musical, I mean, you can sing a melody with your tap. You can say a sentence with your tap. I mean, if you're listening, you can hear it all. It's in there.
Noted performer and choreographer Jason Samuel Smith says tap is a great form to have a battle in. Tonight, he's a judge.
It's about, you know, people just stretching themselves, seeing how far they can take the art form and seeing how good they can be in that moment. And, you know, you live to dance another day if you lose.
Samuel Smith is looking for creativity and a crisp sound. Contests like this have been going on nearly as long as tap itself.
The history of tap really is almost as old as the United States.
That's Lane Alexander, who founded the Chicago Human Rhythm Project. He says tap dates back to the days of slavery. So many people died in the holds of ships, sea captains started bringing slaves up for fresh air and exercise. They do African dances on deck. Irish sailors who'd been pressed into service would respond with their own dances.
And it may have been a moment like that when African and Irish culture first saw each other. And that was the beginning of the process that's gone on for the last 300 years, really, of creating a new American art form of tap dance.
That old art form is appealing to a new generation. All the contestants at the cutting contest are men and women in their teens and 20s, like Matthew Shields from Texas.
There's like a challenge there to one up the other dancers. You have to be quick on your toes, and it's a learning experience. You know, you grow after you do something like this.
He started tapping as a kid when he got dragged to his sister's dance classes. The leaders put all the boys in a room with some tap shoes and promised them pizza. Shields was hooked.
I really liked the communication through your mind into the floor. I mean, there's a whole body connection there. It has to go from all the way to the top, all the way to the bottom, and then out.
He dances his way back to the auditorium with minutes to go. He doesn't know it yet, but Tristan Bruins from the South Loop will be his first opponent.
Right now, like, my head feels like it's full of helium, and my heart's thumping in my chest, and my stomach's a little queasy, and I'm really afraid, but it's so much fun. I mean, this is what people write books about, like this feeling. This is the feeling people write songs about, to get up in front of people and just kind of come up with whatever's in your head. You know, you can really express yourself.
Minutes later, Bruins comes up against Shields. Jason Samuel Smith gives them a waltz tempo.
One, two, three, two.
They both struggle. Samuel Smith starts them over again. Shields is the first dancer who crosses the stage and gets into his opponent's space. He wins this round, but eventually gets beaten by a young Brazilian.
May the best dancer win. Here we go.
In the end, it's the young woman from Tokyo with excellent timing and rhythm, who's not quite so flashy, who wins. Ryona Otsuka gets $100 in breaking rights. I'm Lynette Kalsness.
This is Sidetrack. When John F. King's drum kit was stolen out of his car, he thought it was the end of the world. He had recently quit his job to make a living as a musician and was drumming for hours a day along San Francisco's waterfront. King decided to make lemonade out of lemons. He built his own drum kit from things he found at Goodwill, and surprisingly, he started attracting bigger audiences than ever before. Today, King dazzles audiences as he runs around a table filled with kitchenware, creating his unique and catchy sound. More from Julie Napolin.
Every weekend by the Embarcadero waterfront, John F. King II plays his unusual drum kit built of buckets, pots, and pans. King calls it Street Beats, a music of the city and for the city.
Sometimes you walk down the street and you can just listen to the cars and the horns and the trains and the people talking and the slamming of doors, and it all seems to make sense. Bang, doop doop, bing pop, doop bing bing pop, doop doop pop, and it's just the rhythm of the city.
The idea for his current drum set came several years ago when King was separated from his drums for a week.
I went crazy. I had that itch. So the place that we found to stay had a basement, and I took some pots and pans down to the basement and put them on a rug and got down on my hands and knees and started playing them. And I went, oh my God, this is amazing.
King hadn't really worked with the idea until disaster struck. His car was broken into and his entire drum kit stolen. A friend and fellow musician gave him some advice.
He told me, you know what, it doesn't matter that your drums are gone. You could play a cardboard box or anything because the drum is within you. You possess the power of the music. So just play whatever you have to play.
Drumming had become his living. In order to keep playing, he went dumpster diving and put together his makeshift drum set.
I have a brand new drum set, just like that.
Most people are so impressed, they leave cash in his large bucket.
I wouldn't call it pulling in money. I would call it survival.
Several times a week, King gets up at 3 a.m., drives from Sacramento to the city, and plays his homemade drum set for 6 hours at a time with his entire body. Stomping with bells on his legs, running around in rapid circles, he sometimes plays until his hands bleed.
I played in the pouring rain for 5 hours yesterday. And I felt like, you know what, this is not going to work. I should just pack up and go home. And then I thought to myself, why? This is what I'm here for.
Before becoming a street musician, King had made a decision to leave a stable job as a chef. He says the American dream of a 401k and benefits didn't fit his vision of himself.
I'd rather be doing what I'm doing than putting in 60 hours a week running a restaurant or a kitchen where, you know, I'm thinking all day that I'd rather be playing drums, you know. It's kind of like that old Todd Rundgren song, I don't want to work, I don't want to play, I just want to bang on my drum all day. It's pretty simple.
King was just looking to survive as a musician, and a strange thing happened. People loved it.
Most people come by and they see me perform on the street. One of the first things that strikes them is that, wow, this guy is giving up everything he's got to put on this show. Every ounce of sweat, every ounce of energy. I have a couple of pedicab drivers that drive by and are very supportive and always say hello. And they call me the hardest working man in show business.
I'm Julian Appelin.
You're tuned to Sidetrack. Like the street drummer we just featured, there's another San Francisco area musician who makes music with an unusual instrument. He goes by the name of Robbie Virus, and he plays the theremin, the space-age electronic instrument made famous in 1950s UFO films. He plays with a neo-lounge band called Project Pimento.
You've gotta have heart.
Corazon.
All you really need is heart.
Corazon.
When the odds are saying you'll never win, that's when the grin should start. You've gotta have hope.
Corazon.
Back in 2007, I talked with Robbie Virus and the singer of the band, Lola Bombay, a.k.a. Lori Carcillo. They had just released their second album titled Space Age Love Songs. I asked them first, why a theremin?
You mean...
Why? You know, what's it with a theremin? Why were you drawn to it?
You know, I'd read about it, and there was a documentary that came out on the theremin probably 12 years ago or so, and, you know, I saw that and it just inspired me. Something about it really intrigued me. I wanted to learn how to play it. You know, the idea of making music by just waving your hands in the air just seemed like a cool thing to do.
Well, for those who don't know what a theremin is, give us a brief description of the instrument and how it's played.
So visually, it looks like a sort of a box with two antennas sticking out of it. One sticks straight up in the air, and the other is a loop antenna that sticks out the side. And the instrument has oscillators inside, which make basically a radio field around the instrument. And when you put your hands in the field, by moving the position of your hands, you can control the pitch and the volume. So it's the only instrument you play without actually touching the instrument.
Now, the theremin, most people will recognize from bad sci-fi and horror films of the 1950s, sort of has a rocky past to it. What made you guys think that it would work with lounge and pop tunes?
Well, when I started playing the theremin, I also started to get into lounge music at that point, and I don't know, something just clicked in my head. I was like, oh, these two would go together.
Yeah, and I think that people are kind of drawn to the idea of the theremin, and it's almost like a gimmick, but then they come and they hear the music, and they're like, oh, this is, like, real music, this is good, and they, well, at least, you know, I think it's good. And so I we get a lot of positive comments about it, I guess.
Well, Lori, I wanted to talk to you in particular as being the singer. The theremin itself has this very vocal quality to its sound. It's very ghostly, and it's almost like you're singing a duet in each song.
Yeah. Now,
does this affect the way that you approach the songs?
Not so much. I mean, that's a very good way of putting it. I think I look at the theremin as like another lead instrument, like you might have a saxophone or a trumpet or something like that. But we do a little bit of interplay on some of the songs, and actually on a lot of the songs. And I think I do consider the sound of the theremin, I mean, trying to just sort of weave vocals in with the theremin sound.
Yes, and when we're working on arrangements, actually, you know, it comes up sometimes that Lori will kind of yell at me like, hey, you're playing in the same range as I am. Because they really do, you know, the voice and the theremin can sound very similar, and you have to kind of work it out so that, you know, they're not in the same space at the same time.
Right, we don't want to be shrieky.
Well, Lori, you mentioned just a while ago talking about a theremin lounge band being labeled or can possibly be labeled as a gimmicky sort of band. And you guys don't do that. You actually back what you guys up with some serious musicianship. How do you walk that line between having fun with the instrument but not falling into self-parody?
Right. That is a difficult thing. I mean, I feel like we have a sense of humor about it, but we don't like do a whole lot of shtick, and that may be part of why people like to come see us. I'm not really sure. It just kind of happens, I guess, for us. Robbie, do you have any?
Well, you know, with the theremin, it's very easy to make it sound really gimmicky. You can use a lot of vibrato and, you know, give it sort of that flying saucer sound. But I tend to avoid that. I tend to play it like a real instrument, like a melodic instrument. And so, you know, visually, it's kind of a gimmick because people are like, hey, what is that? Because most people haven't seen a theremin. But, you know, audibly, it's fit into the ensemble as another instrument, as a real instrument. And so, you know, I don't make it gimmicky in the musical sense.
Well, how do you compare this new album, Space Age Love Songs, with your debut album, Magical Moods of the Theremin? How have you guys changed, and, you know, where have you guys stayed the same?
The personnel on the two albums are different. Lola and I are the only two that have played on both albums, so it's a new guitarist, a new bass player, and a new drummer. And so that has changed the sound somewhat. I also think just by playing out a lot, we've sort of refined our sound and our repertoire. The first album came out maybe a year or two after we were together. And then it was, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 years between the two albums.
Great. And if people want to learn more about Project Pimento, where should they go?
www.projectpimento.com.
That was Lola Bombay, a.k.a. Lori Carcillo, and theremin player Robbie Virus, members of the theremin lounge band Project Pimento. That interview first aired in 2007. You're listening to Sidetrack. Every good cause needs some celebrity support, and poetry is no different. Bill Murray joined hundreds of people at an event recently for the Poets House in New York. He's a frustrated poet himself, as independent producer Eric Malinsky found out.
Summer is a great time to walk across the Brooklyn Bridge, especially with a bunch of poets.
You can almost read New York City like a poem. Each street is like a line. It's so enjambed. There's kind of a rhythm and a pace to each block. And so the bridge walk is a way to do a close reading.
Lee Brissetti's a board member of Poets House. It's a national center for poetry. They do this fundraiser every year where they walk across the Brooklyn Bridge. There were esteemed poets, wannabe poets, patrons of the arts, and a celebrity. You know Tom's of Maine Toothpaste? Well, Tom Chappelle was there with his wife, Kate.
We use poetry a lot in our company.
Well, I've used your toothpaste.
Well,
my whole family does,
believe
actually.
Believe it or not, it's one of the ingredients in your toothpaste indirectly.
Really?
Because we start every meeting with a poem. So.
Really?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, there was another celebrity that I wanted to meet.
you write poetry, right?
Not for a long time, but.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But it used to get you out of doing homework in grade school if you could write poetry. You know, you could act distracted all the time.
Yeah, that's Bill Murray. He comes to this event almost every summer.
I've got an annoying neighbor named Frank Platt who's on the board, and he's been dragging me around, making me do things all around New York for about 20 years, been making me go and do things that I would never do.
Thank you, Bill. It was a snap.
Frank Platt really is Bill Murray's next-door neighbor. He watched Murray's kids grow up.
See, this guy here crossed the bridge when he was 2 weeks old, maybe less than 2 weeks old the first time.
Oh, really?
Lincoln Murray, yeah. And that's Homer Murray. Cooper Murray, and there go the Murrays.
When Frank Platt met Bill Murray in the mid-1980s, Murray was already deep into poetry. He'd show up at Harvard unannounced to read poems to the students. But his own poetry was pretty bad, and he knew it.
Did you ever have ambitions of, maybe even publishing some of your old poems, or no?
No. No, I've got, I need an injection of ambition, yeah. To be honest with you.
So is it just too frustrating to try and write poetry when you would love?
My frustrations start early. They start early and end late. You know what? There's a whole list. I should probably write a poem about the list of my frustrations. As a matter of fact, if I may borrow your pencil, that's what I'm going to do when I get home. I'm going to write a poem about the list of my frustrations.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I appreciate this a lot. I'm glad I woke up today.
Getting involved with Poets House, Murray was able to meet some of his own personal heroes, like Billy Collins.
And then he wrote one about divorce recently that's really wicked, that also feels like it echoes in your ribs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Murray's divorce was all over the tabloids that week. I wasn't sure if he'd show up, but he loves this organization. I have to admit, I was just there to meet him. I don't know much about poetry, but throughout the walk and the dinner afterwards, I heard some really great stuff.
Praise the cook with a shaven head and a tattoo on his shoulder that said, Oye. A blue-eyed Puerto Rican with people from Fajardo, the harbor of pirates centuries ago. Praise the lighthouse in Fajardo, candle glimmering white to worship the dark saint of the sea. Alabanza.
A conversation stops and I look up to see the harmony of the cables and the arch. I have been raised to see the world in terms of work.
We wanted our sufferings to be offered up as tender meat and our triumphs to be belted out as raucous song.
I eat oatmeal for breakfast. I make it on the hot plate and put skimmed milk on it. I eat it alone.
Bill Murray read a poem called Oatmeal by Galway Canal.
But when he got home, he couldn't figure out the order of the stanzas. And he and a friend spread the papers on a table, and they made some sense of them, but he isn't sure to this day if they got it right. He still wonders about the occasional sense of drift between stanzas and the way here and there a line will go into the configuration of a Muslim at prayer, then raise itself up and peer about, and then lay down slightly off the mark, causing the poem to move forward with God's reckless wobble.
Canal's poem is about the frustration of trying to write poetry. I think Bill Murray related to it.
Oh, you're too kind. Well, maybe I will read some of my own stuff.
I'm Eric Malinsky.
Still to come, a look at the world through the eyes of the television show The Simpsons and the owner of the Venice Beach Freak Show in California. Stay tuned. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. A lot of American swimmers recently watched the Olympic trials. dreaming of someday winning and going to the Olympics. Some have other hopes. Charlie Schlenker tells us about a Central Illinois boy who can't use his legs, but makes up for it with heart and head and arms.
You finish the set and you're done. A set is like a race.
It's evening practice at the Redbird Swim Club in Normal. Coach John Almeida yells through the humid air and splashing echoes for the kids in the pool to keep at it. In the end lane, Trevor Tucci of Bloomington strokes back and forth. Trevor is waif thin, but has huge shoulders and a big chest for his age, tapering to a tiny waist. He's 8. Trevor was born with a hole in his back, and the spina bifida means he has no movement and little feeling below the belt line. Dad Mark says the family bought a house with a pool just before Trevor was born, so lessons were a priority. Trevor went into the water for the first time at age 4. It caught on.
The best thing I like is he can swim in that lane over there, and there's an 18-year-old in the lane next to him. They're all treated the same, and the camaraderie is unbelievable.
Trevor swims all 4 strokes, freestyle, butterfly, back, and breast. His favorite is freestyle and longer events. Most kids his age swim 25 meters, maybe 50 in a race. Trevor likes 100s and 200s, but not for any reason you'd expect.
It's a lot more funner because you get to flip turn. You get to flip turn in the water, the circle.
A lot of swimmers like race days, but don't like the drudgery of practice. Not Trevor.
Because you get to work really hard and you get a lot of energy. Sometimes if you like get bored, you might want to practice swimming.
Trevor swims about 1,600 meters of practice, call it within splashing distance of a mile per session. And he is surprisingly fast. He beats a few kids who have no disabilities now and then. Only once in 3 years had they seen another swimmer with a disability at a club meet. So Dad Mark says it was a real stunner when the family went to a meet for such swimmers in Michigan.
And they looked at me and asked how old he was and looked at his times and came back and said, you know, he's got a shot in the Paralympic swimming to go a long way. I couldn't believe it.
Trevor just set a national record age group time for swimmers with disabilities and won 3 gold medals and 4 silvers at nationals.
And I think as his muscles develop and he mature, it's going to be fun to watch. You're going to move fast.
John Almeida has 4 decades of coaching experience. Almeida has helped 2 Olympians, 1 a medalist, and a handful of national champions. He says those swimmers share something he also sees in Trevor.
I think it's from their heart. We just watch them and applaud. You give some work and you show their inside effort. Come from within each individual and they always surprise you, and that's what he does.
The Paralympics are always held in the same city as the Olympics, just afterward. Now, don't go booking a slot yet for London in 2012, or dare we say it, Chicago in 2016, but Trevor shows promise. And Mark Tucci says it will be an interesting 8 years, maybe 4.
He always wants to improve. You know, he just goes and goes and goes. And it's really amazing, especially for an 8-year-old to have that determination, let alone somebody with a disability who has no legs. I mean, who's using all arms.
You have to remember Trevor is only 8. Dad may dream about Paralympics, perhaps blessedly just as yet. Trevor says he does not. His goals are both nearer and more distant than competing against other swimmers with disabilities.
Sometimes I have a dream about me making it to the state cut sometimes, or me, like, improving times or swimming.
10 and a 35. 10 and a 45. No break in between.
That's a tough task, though Coach Almeida says Trevor's example encourages the older swimmers. And the younger ones? Well, Almeida's a crafty teacher who uses the motivational tools that come his way.
Trevor's an inspiration for all of us here. When some of the little kids feel a little sore for themselves, I will tell them, Trevor's never sore about himself.
Trevor is calm as he talks about swimming. He's far more animated as he chatters on about the cool Tony Hawk video game and baseball and other very important kid things.
Like sometimes, like my brother, we'd go on the mat and like we'd play hand soccer.
Hand soccer? How do you play that?
Yeah, like there's like 2 people.
But he says there is something he wants others to know about it.
But even though you can't kick, you could still be a good swimmer.
Swimming teaches a lot about life. It teaches discipline and demonstrates hard work paying off. It teaches competition against oneself. But Trevor Tucci, age 8, offers another lesson for the rest of us. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
listening to Sidetrack. A central New York sociologist and college professor says one of America's longest-running and popular television shows offers more than just entertainment. Tim Delaney teaches sociology at SUNY Oswego and has written a book about the TV show The Simpsons. The characters poke fun at almost every social situation, and as Delaney tells us, there's a little bit of The Simpsons in all of us.
I'm Tim Delaney. I'm the author of Simpsonology, There's a Little Bit of Springfield in All of Us. I'm a sociology professor at SUNY Oswego. The book is about the TV show The Simpsons, of course, but more than just a review of people's favorite episodes. It's also talking about the social significance of The Simpsons. Matt Groening, the creator of the Simpsons, had decided long ago that when he established The Simpsons, he wanted to do kind of a satire of the traditional American family, and what was the traditional American family, where you had the breadwinner father, the stay-at-home mother, wife, and their children all living in the same dwelling. And, of course, that, you know, now is the rarity in American society. You have Lisa, who is the ultimate activist. She's always got a cause.
Day and night by the big cooling tower. They have the plans, but we have the power.
We've already alluded to Homer and his ineptness in the workplace to a certain degree. And certainly we have to wonder how he keeps his job, but he does.
Accidents have doubled every year since he became safety inspector. And meltdowns have tripled. Has he been fired? No. Has he been disciplined? No, no.
And Bart, of course, you know, is the problem child. He's the stereotypical problem child, you know, the 10-year-old that's always getting into various types of problems.
No way! I didn't do it! Unlike all the other stuff I told you I didn't do, which I did.
And there's Marge all the way through. She is the glue of the family. She keeps that house together.
I mean, I think you did great. And to celebrate, I made omelets from the eggs people threw at our house.
She keeps the kids happy. She keeps Homer happy. And somehow she puts up with Homer's, you know, deeds of deviance.
I am smart. I am smart. S-M-R-T. I mean, S-M-A-R-T.
They go to church regularly. As far as we know, every single Sunday. Marge seems to be completely in favor of it. The kids go along because, you know, that's what kids do. They go wherever their parents take them at that age. Homer goes most of the time, and of course there's been a few episodes where he stays at home. One episode in particular, he stayed home the whole day. Marge and the kids went. The car broke down. It was a snowstorm. You know, they had to come home. And Homer is at home watching football, and he says, "This was the best day of my life," which of course doesn't go over too well with the rest of the Simpson family.
"I'm never going to church again."
Homer, are you actually giving up your faith?
No. Well, yes.
It is a very violent show. One of the advantages, of course, of being an animated cartoon, that every time when Homer chokes his son, Bart,
"I'll teach you to laugh at something that's funny,"
and it gets very animated. You know, of course, if this happened in real life, you'd have to call child services. You know, that's a real problem. But it's a TV show. But actually, The Simpsons are making a commentary about violence in society, that there are, in fact, a lot of violent TV shows and cartoons. Healthcare is a big thing. You know, somebody's always getting hurt, so we're seeing them go to the Springfield Hospital.
"Would take your mind off your dead son."
"I thought he was in a coma."
"They're pretty much the same thing. Except this way I get to keep billing you."
But, you know, one of the episodes I find most interesting is when Homer, you know, he's late for work over and over. And he just doesn't want to go to work. And he would love to work at home, as a lot of people probably would. And he learns that if he exceeds a certain weight limit, that he qualifies for disability and he can work from home. And the power plant has to create an office for him.
What can I do to speed the whole thing up, Doctor?
Be creative. Instead of making sandwiches with bread, use Pop-Tarts. Instead of chewing gum, chew bacon.
So what we're actually learning about here, though, is the very serious problem of obesity. You know, there are people in the health professions that refer to this as an epidemic. So clearly this is something of great concern. But they also point out, you know, the fact that most of us, you know, a lot of people can't afford health care. Even people with health coverage don't have adequate coverage. That is another one of those running themes, and it's a serious issue. It's easy for some people to discount The Simpsons as just a crude, animated show that relies on, like, potty humor, trying to appeal to lowest common denominator. And to a certain degree, I mean, that is true. I mean, they rely on a lot of very face value type of humor.
The fingers you have used to dial are too fat. To obtain a special dialing wand, please mash the keypad with your palm now.
I think when you really look at The Simpsons, there's a lot going on. They make references to literary greats from the past. They talk about historical figures. They tell us about the origins of April Fools and Halloween and so on and so forth. Also, I think what's really good about The Simpsons, why they have lasted so long, is that they don't necessarily take a stand politically to the left or to the right. They manage to offend everybody, to the left, to the right, in the middle. And eventually, you know, if they haven't upset you politically or on certain issues, gun control.
Can I get my ball down from the roof, Dad?
Sure thing, honey. You want me to get the cat?
Whether you're for it or against it, they have something for everybody there. Some students today find it hard to believe that The Simpsons at one time, that was the show that people protested, the family rights groups, religious groups, they were all up in arms about the show.
We're going to keep on trying to strengthen the American family, to make American families a lot more like the Waltons and a lot less like The Simpsons.
Huh? Whereas today, by today's standards, there's a lot of other shows that are probably, you know, pushing the envelope, you know, even further. But The Simpsons, they remain. And I think another thing about writing a book about The Simpsons, they've been, you know, on the air for over 20 years now. They show no signs of disappearing anytime in the near future. So clearly Matt Groening, he plans on keeping The Simpsons as a part of pop culture for a long time to come.
Tim Delaney teaches sociology at Sunny Oswego. That feature was produced by Jason Smith. This is Sidetrack. Summer is the time for road trips. And if you're looking for places to go and things to see, Chris Epting is your man. He's obsessed with popular culture and road trips. He has written several books about where to find pop culture items across the country. His books include James Dean Died Here, Marilyn Monroe Died Here, and Elvis Presley Died Here. Back in 2006, Jeff Bosser talked with Epting upon the publication of his book, The Ruby Slippers, Madonna's Bra, and Einstein's Brain. It was published by Santa Monica Press.
Tell me a bit about how this series started up. Did you, went back when you did, I don't know which one came first in the series of the Celebrity Died Here books, but did you intend to continue doing a series on all these pop culture items, some in larger museums, some just roadside attractions?
You know what? I really wasn't sure. The first one of these I did was called James Dean Died Here, and it included, in addition to the site where James Dean died, about 700 places around the country where lots of things happened, where things were invented, where movies were filmed, all sorts of things that sort of have entered the public consciousness of pop culture. And, you know, the book found an audience, and that's why I decided to do a sequel to it, and then another sequel, and then this one here. Because it's, you know, the more you you dig, the more you find. And, you know, while the title may make it seem like it's just going to be about where James Dean died, really, in fact, you know, all my books have 8 chapters that will cover, you know, places where sporting events happened, or I mentioned movies and television, you know, famous crimes and things like that. So I try and really run the gamut of all those different events that we learned about in school, or, you know, just sort of moved us while we were growing up.
Now, did you grow up being a big traveler with your family? I mean, is this born from something that, you know, you did a lot of road trips as a kid?
We took some interesting trips. I think the aspect that always held my fascination was when we would stand somewhere where something had happened. I remembered standing once in a little cabin where George Washington had, like, just stood for maybe a minute and looked over a map and said, you know, we'll go this way. And I just remember as a kid thinking, wow, that guy on the dollar bill was in this very room, you know. And I remember going to where the Hindenburg had crashed and thinking about what that was like. And I always had this really special feeling going back to where things happened. Maybe it was where Ebbets Field used to be in Brooklyn or something. And even though the stadium's gone, thinking about what it was like the day Jackie Robinson played his first game. So, yeah, as a kid, I loved that sense of being where great things happened or infamous things happened. And it just sort of spun out of control after I became an adult.
Yeah, I mean, I have to think that my favorite portion of this, and I would say maybe some other people would choose the same thing, is roadside relics. I mean, how do you find out about some of these things that, you know, are just maybe a quick photo op?
Well, yeah, you mentioned roadside relics. That's a chapter in the new book. And, you know, I just love the way America kind of celebrates things like, you know, world's biggest anything. You know what I mean? You've got a lot of small towns that to take credit for things they're famous for, whether it's the world's biggest strawberry or olive or box of raisins or whatever, it's become something that they'll put these things up to kind of, you know, one part of it is pride to let you know what they've done there. The other part is I think to reel you in a little bit, maybe let you spend a couple of bucks in their town and, you know, go buy fried artichokes or something in the artichoke capital of the world. But I love the sense of American ingenuity that spins out of these great roadside oddities. And because so many of them, you know, whether it's a replica of Stonehenge up in Washington State or whatever, they're such labors of love. And I think the more you learn about them, it really makes it fun to find these places on a road trip and think about what the passion and craziness was behind them.
Now, how do you find out about some of these things? I mean, obviously, I mean, you have the Smithsonian in here and some larger museums. You have Graceland, a lot of things that are easily accessible on the web. But exactly. But where do you, you know, how do you catch word about something that's you know, I have to mention one that I grew up near the Gemini Giant outside the launching pad in Wilmington, Illinois. I mean, that's very close to where I'm from. So,
and it's a classic.
Yes. Well, how do you find out about things like that?
I learned about these. My family and I, my wife and I, have 2 children, a 12-year-old son and a 9-year-old daughter. And our vacations are all pretty much spent as crazy fun road trips. And I'm always sort of in the midst of researching a book. So what happens is, you know, a lot of towns, they're just waiting for you. You know what I mean? They want to tell you about what makes them special or notable. And when you write a couple of books like this, too, it puts you in touch with so many people who have ideas and kind of want to share things in their backyard. So it's really the process has been feeding itself now for a couple of years where, you know, I have a list of things in my head I want to go check out, like the Gemini Giant. But then when you go there, somebody will say, hey, you know, have you checked out the world's largest bottle of ketchup? Or have you gone to see, you know, the world's biggest crayon? Everyone's got those stories in their back pocket. So I always find the more you travel, the more people you meet, that really, you know, helps you connect the dots, and one thing definitely leads to another.
Well, the nice thing about that, too, while we love the convenience of the internet, I mean, your research for finding out about these is, you know, hit the road. You didn't, I mean, I'm sure you've surfed the web for some things, but it was nice to find out about these things via word of mouth.
Well, you know, that's the thing. And I this new book, The Ruby Slippers, has about 400 photos in it. And I take most of those pictures. And I always feel like the best way to accurately describe something or get kind of the inside story, and I like to cram as many, you know, backstage facts and trivia as I can in these books, is to go there and meet people. There's really no shortcut for that. And that's the fun part, too. I mean, again, the local color, when the kids hear all the different accents around the country and the way people talk and the phrases, you know, the magic of it really comes from going to a lot of these places. Of course, everyone can't go everywhere. So I like to think a book like this is just as good at home in an armchair as it is on the road. But, you know, yeah, going there firsthand to me is really part of the magic and what makes it special. And our kids, I think, get a nice kind of, you know, if strange angle on history, but it's interesting too for them.
Well, and when you complete this series, however many, if you're done or if you have more, it would seem to me that you've probably had some interesting stories. You could do sort of an offshoot book after you're done with just a list of pop culture artifacts.
Yeah, you know, I've started writing some essays and things on my website, because you're exactly right. What happens, the stories almost are a different sort of writing and pieces that you come up with. Not too long ago, I went to shoot some photos in the old Ambassador Hotel, where Bobby Kennedy was shot, which was torn down a couple of months ago. But that little trip and our little tour in there, I took lots of photos, and again, it was more than just an entry in a book. It was something I wanted to write sort of a deeper article about. So, you know, I started collecting essays and ideas and things, and just experiences with people, because we've met such wonderful characters out there who are so the real torchbearers of a lot of these small towns and things, who just have such marvelous ways of describing things and like letting you in on their history. So, yeah, my plan at this point is I'd love to kind of I think 8 books now that involve North America. I'd like to kind of branch out. I'm working on a rock and roll road trip right now that will actually cover parts of Europe and things. So ultimately, I'd love to cover the whole planet and go visit, you know, places for everybody who wants to go stand where something happened or go visit some interesting offbeat museum or artifact. I'd like to, you know, like to think these books make it a little bit easier for you.
Now, while you might be writing another book about essays coming up, have these books helped you know, bring in some more people? Have you heard back from, you know, the owners of some museum or?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a part of my thing is really trying to shine a light on places like that. So whenever I can, I like to include information and you know, make it easier for people to go visit. And I've heard from tons of whether it's curio shops or roadside oddities or, you know, the Pez Museum or whatever. Once you put it in a book and go out and talk about it and include it in articles, they see a difference and they love it. I get lots of great. I have a folder from notes from chambers of commerce in small places that like the fact that you included, you know, their place in a positive light and everything. So, which again, to me, is just sort of a perk of doing stuff like this, is being able to steer people, because it's tough, you know, with all the interstates. A lot of those, you know, the great Route 66s of the world aren't there anymore, and you've still got businesses sort of off the beaten path that need you to come visit. So, again, part of it, to me, it's almost like providing a public service. I want people to go and explore a little bit and really get to the heart and soul of what makes, you know, American popular culture so interesting.
Is there someone out there who you may have inspired to think, okay, what world's largest item has not been, you know, put out there yet? What can I do to lure people to this small town?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, and via the internet, it's kind of easy for people to write you. So I get tips and suggestions all the time. I work with a hotel chain, actually, who makes a part of their business to go out and refurbish landmarks. So restoration and preservation has sort of, you know, been another nice byproduct of this, to go out and kind of, you know, again, identify places that might need some help and then some funding and things like that. But also remind places, you know, a lot of times people aren't even aware of what's in their own town or backyard. So I'll go do public speaking and things, and people will be shocked to learn that, you know, Joe DiMaggio might have lived in their town and donated his personal boat to the marina or whatever. And it's fun when you see people's reactions who live in a place that weren't aware of something that was essentially right under their nose.
We talk about some of your earlier work. I have not had a chance to look at some of the other ones that were connected to. But how did the titles come up through James Dean, Marilyn Monroe? I mean, obviously that was the hook, and then you went on from there.
Well, when you're doing a book about pop culture, you know, my thought was you need names and identities that sort of represent more than just their category. James Dean, to me, is not just so much an actor. He really was sort of one of the first pop culture, you know, mythological figures, because he was killed so young. Same thing for Marilyn and Elvis. They kind of transcend one category, and I think just those mere names sort of stand for popular culture. And that's why after the James Dean one, we thought, well, God, you've got to do sort of the triumvirate here. It's those three that make up sort of the holy pop culture trinity, as it were, which is why I wanted to include all their names. And similarly with the new book, you know, when you say the Ruby Slippers, Madonna's bra, and Einstein's brain, those are very compelling things. And again, use those names, Einstein, Madonna, Ruby Slippers. Those conjure up imagery right away that I think is interesting to people.
I like the fact that, too, that you have a missing in action section. I mean, a while back I interviewed someone from the Volvo Car Museum and talked about their quest to get James Dean's car what's left of it because it was, you know, somebody made off with it, and they're offering this huge reward for the thing.
I appreciate you mentioning that. I wanted to. This was kind of a last-minute thought. I said to the publisher, you know, there are things I can't find that sort of selfishly, personally, I'd love to enlist people's help. And because, you know, people read these books and it becomes a bit of a treasure hunt or scavenger hunt. So in the back of the new book, like you mentioned, I've got 10 artifacts I'd love to see located that have sort of disappeared, as it were, in the midst of time. One of them is like the Partridge Family bus. And I put the whole story in and where it was last sighted and, you know, what the story behind it is. The Bobby Thompson home run ball from 1951 is another one. You mentioned, I mean, the car James Dean was killed in, that car disappeared. All that's left, as you said, is the door. And it was, they used to use that car. It was sort of a crumbled up sardine can, as it were, as a, you know, the highway department would take it around and show it to people, you know, to sort of scare them and say, don't let this happen to you. And they would take it to high schools and show it to young drivers and things. But, you know, where is that car today? So I've got a list of these things, the guitar Jimi Hendrix played at Monterey that he famously lit on fire. And I like to think, you know, again, I've already, actually people have already written me about some of these things with little details about where it may be. Not the James Dean car, unfortunately. But I got a note the other day from somebody who thinks they've got a piece of the Jimi Hendrix guitar. So, you know, you put it in a book, you get it out there in the public, and you never know what can come from that.
So what's next for you? You talked about the essays. Is that what we might see come out next?
Well, I've started putting a few on, like I said, on my website. The next book I'm working on for next year is a rock and roll road trip that really kind of gets into the heart of music from Elvis to the Beatles to the Stones and everything in between, kind of a blues tour through the Mississippi Delta to go and touch all the spots where music history was made. And then after that, I'm not sure. I got a couple of thoughts I'm sort of kicking around now. And the essays, I think, I'm going to likely gather in a year or two and try and put together. I'm a huge Charles Kuralt fan. He was sort of one of my heroes as a kid. And I loved reading his books that really just visited cities and talked about those cities and sort of brought them to life for people that had never been there. So with that as my inspiration, I'm thinking of pulling some essays together based on some of my travels and seeing if I can, you know, pull something together that people might want to read.
That was Jeff Bossert speaking with Chris Epting about his book, The Ruby Slippers, Madonna's Bra, and Einstein's Brain. The publisher is Santa Monica Press. That interview first aired in 2006. You're listening to Sidetrack. Carnivals are a popular summertime activity, but one element that has been phased out of the modern carnival is the freak show. Todd Ray is trying to bring that back. He's the owner of the Venice Beach Freak Show in California. He told his story to independent producer Brianna O'Higgins.
Since the beginning of time, there's been animals and people born different. Different than the normal mold that we normally come out of, the form that we've accepted as normal. So anything that's not like them, it's a freak. And now I want to see what's different from me. My name is Todd Ray, and I'm the owner of the Venice Beach Freak Show.
World, stranger than anything you've ever seen in your life. Folks, you gotta see the two-headed cat. There's a little
kid. It started out when I was a kid. And I had a love of the circus, crazy love of the circus, anytime it came to town. A big one, Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey Circus, or just the small ones that would just come through. And I was always the kid that would sneak under the tent to see what was going on.
All right, ladies, welcome to the Venice Beach Freak Show. We're going to walk through these curtains, and I'm going to show you some of the strangest creatures in the world. Come right on in. Now, if you look over here, you'll see some of our strange pigs, starting with our two-mouthed pig. Can you see it right there? Now, if you see this little piggy, he was born with eight legs, four ears right here, look. One, two, three, four. And two tails. One, two. And that's because this pig was born with one head but two bodies. This is his brother that's growing up.
As I kept watching the kids, the parents would come out, not always, but the ones that would come out horrified, the kids would just be like, that was awesome. That's incredible. Mama, and they, of course, when they walk back, they got to come back in and all that. But the parents would always try to hold them back. Like, they don't want them to see it. You know, I didn't know it was going to be that intense, or I didn't know, you know. So it really, it does. It comes down to it, like, you know, people through culture and through education and their ideas, that's the key, is ideas. Their whole mental structure in their mind is based on these ideas that they've created or that they've accepted from other people. And as you get older, it boxes you in more and more. Whereas kids, they're not at that point. They're just full of a sense of wonder. They realize that everything is wonderful. You know, they don't, but they, even if they stare at someone that's handicapped, it's like, they're not staring to be insulting. You know how your parents will be, don't look at him. Don't stare. What are you talking about? Stare at him. Go over there and say hey to him. You might learn something. You might actually learn about your own humanity. But if you hide them, now they're scared. Now they feel like, oh, I can't, you know. And then later, of course, if anyone else is looking at them, especially if they're looking at them in a show, what's their response as an adult? Because they've been told over and over again, get away, get away. So I don't do this just to freak people out. I really do it to open up their minds. I'm not closed-minded or anything like that. I'm trying to open their minds. I think if it keeps getting bigger, it'd be really interesting, you know, to see people embrace differences of that level, you know. No, they're real. And if you look close, right between their two hands. The Freak Show is meant to make you question your own identity. And if I get you to do that, you should thank me for only charging you $3.
Myrtle and Squirtle. That was Todd Ray, owner of the Venice Beach Freak Show. That feature comes from independent producer Brianna O'Higgins. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.